Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Richard Blanco. Richard Blanco is the fifth inaugural poet in U.S. history, the youngest first Latino, immigrant, and gay person to serve in such a role. He was recently commissioned by the U.S. Department of State to write a poem for the ceremonial reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. This poem, Matters of the Sea, Cosas del Mar, was released as a bilingual chapbook by the University of Pittsburgh Press. He is the author of the memoirs, The Prince of Los Cucuyos, A Miami Childhood, and For All of Us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey, the poetry chapbooks, One Today in Boston Strong, and the poetry collections, Looking for the Gulf Motel, Directions to the Beach of the Dead, and City of 100 Fires. Blanco's many awards include the Agnes Lynch Sterrett Prize from the University of Pittsburgh Press, the Beyond Margins Award from the Pan American Center, the Patterson Poetry Prize, and the Tom Gunn Award. A builder of cities as well as poems, Blanco holds a BS in civil engineering and an MFA in creative writing. Hi, Richard. How are you?
How are you?
It's really good to have you in Pittsburgh. And
to be here.
Yeah, we love Richard Blanco in Pittsburgh. So, please start with whatever you'd like.
I'd like to share this poem called Looking for the Gulf Motel, which is about going back to one of those places in my childhood and sort of trying to recapture something of the past, sort of taking a proverbial trip down memory lane that didn't go so well. Looking for the Gulf Motel, Marco Island, Florida. There should be nothing here, I don't remember. The Gulf Motel with mermaid lampposts and ship's wheel in the lobby should still be rising out of the sand like a cake decoration. My brother and I should still be pretending we don't know our parents, embarrassing us as they roll the luggage cart past the front desk, loaded with our scruffy suitcases, 2 dozen loaves of Cuban bread, brown bags bulging with enough mangoes to last the entire week, our espresso pot, the pressure cooker, and a pork roast reeking garlic through the marble lobby. All because we can't afford to eat out, mijo. Not even on vacation. Only 2 hours from our home in Miami, but far enough away to be thrilled by the wider sands on the west coast of Florida, where I should still be, for the first time, watching the sun set instead of rise over the ocean. There should be nothing here, I don't remember. My mother should still be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her daisy sandals from Kmart squeaking across the linoleum, still gorgeous in her teal swimsuit and amber earrings, stirring a pot of arroz con pollo, adding sprinkles of onion powder and dollops of tomato sauce. My father should still be in a terry cloth jacket, smoking, clinking a glass of amber whiskey in the sunset at the Gulf Motel, watching us dive into the pool, 2 boys he'll never see grow into men who will be proud of him. There should be nothing here, I don't remember. My brother and I should still be playing Parcheesi. My father should still be alive, slow dancing with my mother on the sliding glass balcony of the Gulf Motel. No music. Only the waves keeping time. A song only their minds hear, 10,000 nights back to their life in Cuba. My mother's face should still be resting against his bare chest, like the moon resting on the sea. And the stars should still be turning around them. There should be nothing here, I don't remember. My brother should still be 13, sneaking rum in the bathroom and sculpting naked women from sand. And I should still be 8 years old, dazzled by seashells and how many seconds I can hold my breath underwater. But I'm not. I'm 38, driving up Collier Boulevard, looking for the Gulf Motel, for everything that should still be, but isn't. I want to blame the condos, their shadows for ruining the beach and my past. I want to chase the snowbirds away with their tacky McMansions and yachts. I want to turn the golf courses back into mangroves. I want to find the Gulf Motel, exactly as it was, and pretend, pretend for just a moment that nothing I've lost is lost.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Richard Blanco, and he's reading a poem from his book, the title poem, Looking for the Gulf Hotel. Richard, I wanted to ask you about your details. You have such vivid details that, you know, so many, I mean, just from that, so many in that poem, you know, the daisy sandals from Kmart, the terry cloth jacket of the father, the amber whiskey, it just goes on, and they're so precise, but they bring such energy to the poem. Can you talk about constructing those details or finding them in your body as a poet?
I mean, when you know, we all know that golden rule of show, don't tell. And I think, you know, that needs a little more dimensioning. And I see this sometimes in my own classrooms and workshops, that it's really about, it's about telling through showing, that every detail should in some ways evoke something that's particularly important to the poem and should create the sum of those images, of those sensory details. Or their purpose really is to create some kind of environment, some kind of emotional environment and aura in the poem that leads the reader to, that evokes in the reader some sense of the emotion that I'm trying to impart. And so all those choices are sort of very purposeful. Purposeful in the, or instinctual, I should say, in some ways. The idea of how many thousands of details could I possibly have of the Gulf Motel? And it's really a matter of choosing those that somehow resonate in the poem to create the sense of, as you heard in the poem, the sense of sort of nostalgia, loss, but also longing, displacement, all these kinds of things. So I call my sort of my memory, and I sometimes just imagine stepping back into that room or into that space. And what am I smelling? What am I hearing? What am I touching? And this particular poem is really heavy, as you said, with sensory details. I think it's probably about 98% sensory detail. That's sort of characterized as most of my work, but in this poem in particular. But I always like to give the example of that line where it says, my mother should be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her daisy sandals from Kmart squeaking across the linoleum, still gorgeous in her teal swimsuit and amber earrings, stirring a pot of arroz con pollo. And I always, in class, I always say, now imagine I wrote this. My mother should still be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her red pumps from Neiman Marcus, still squeaking across the marble, still gorgeous in her polka dot bikini and hoop earrings, stirring a pot of baked beans and adding dollops from her dangling cigarette in her mouth. No, that's a whole different environment, right? A whole different emotion. And all I did was change the details. And so it's, I think that our golden rule needs to amplify a little bit in that sense. It's really, like I said, more about telling images, or you get to tell, but what you show should tell something. Mm-hmm. And it's not showing just for the sake of showing.
Right, right. Well, for our writers out there, or maybe beginning writers out there, I know this may be the unanswerable questions, but you have a lifetime of details to choose from. How do you settle on those in this 2.5-page poem? How do you settle on those?
Well, I think it's almost like when the detail sort of strikes the right note, and part of it is instinctual, part of it, some moments are more purposeful. In that particular poem, for example, you know, using in that particular passage, using teal, for example, for my mother's bathing suit. You know, it was a particular color choice because the teal is at once a happy color, but it's also a sad color. It's sort of blue. It's a darker blue. It's sort of
kind of
melancholy.
Green.
You know, the amber earrings, for example, are, you know, they're not diamond earrings. They're amber. The whole poem is, in a way, this idea of trapped in amber. So there's all these echoes. And they're of course called from my entire experience of memory. So was my mother exactly wearing that teal swimsuit at that moment? Maybe not, but I remember her somewhere in my life with a teal swimsuit. Mm-hmm. She did have amber earrings that she wore a lot. And so I just pull those and sort of pull them into this memory and mm-hmm. in a way constructing. And it's just sort of what feels like echoes, or it's almost like music. Like when you feel like that note is right for this poem, and it might be wrong for another poem. But I usually, when I begin writing, I just sort of splatter everything on the page. I just sort of like a painter with a blank canvas and sort of just start echoing everything, writing down everything that echoes about that moment, about that memory, and everything surrounding it. And then I start sort of picking and choosing and sort of, you know, and again, through the revision process as well, you're still sort of thinking about which of these images sort of work and which of these sensory details are doing the most for the poem in a ways that sometimes, again, almost instinctual, because when you're in the feeling of the poem, when you're sort of, and I think the harder part of all that is sort of getting emotionally centered in or finding the emotional center of the poem. And from that, so many choices are informed to just almost again, instinctually or subconsciously or begin to be informed.
Right,
and that's
right.
The hardest part of getting that seed of that poem is like, this is, everything's going to revolve around this center.
Right, right. Okay, could you read another poem or else something from your memoir, whatever you're in the mood to read?
Sure, I'll read another poem. This is, like more like poems today.
Okay.
To read something. Well, since we've been talking about my mother, maybe I'll read a little poem about my father. This is also from the same book, Looking for the Gulf Motel. And to sort of give you a little background, I was always fascinated. I didn't have an adult relationship with my father because he died when I was about 22, and so I never got to have that adult relationship. And on top of that, he was sort of a very emotionally absent man, a wonderful man, but sort of typical of that generation, and then add to that Latino. So there's a lot of, I didn't know about him, and I used poetry in many ways to construct him, to communicate with him in some ways. And one of the things that I've always been proud of is that my hands are just like his hands. And so that was sort of the emotional center of this poem, the entryway into this poem. My father, my hands. My father gave me these hands, fingers inch wide and muscular like his, the same folds of skin, like squinted eyes looking back at me whenever I wash my hands in the kitchen sink and remember him washing garden dirt off his or helping my mother dry the dishes every night. These are his fingernails, square, flat, 10 small mirrors I look into and see him signing my report card or mixing batter for our pancakes on Sunday mornings. His same whorls of hair near my wrists, magnetic lines that pull me back to him, tying my shoelaces, pointing at words as I learn to read, and years later, greasy hands teaching me to change the oil in my car, immaculate hands showing me how to tie my necktie. These are his knuckles, rising, falling like hills between my veins, his veins, his pulse at my wrist under the watch he left for me, ticking since his death. Alive when I hold another man's hand and remember mine around his thumb through the carnival at Tamiami Park. How he lifted me up on his shoulders, his hands wrapped around my ankles, keeping me steady above the world, still.
Yeah, could you read another one?
Oh, sure. So I've always had a problem with my name. I've renamed myself in many ways. And I think that's part of the quest for identity and cultural identity and sort of how I see myself in different parts of my life and whatnot. And I also have a bunch of nicknames and all the rest. So this poem is sort of all about my name and also wrapped around this sense of, as a younger child, as a child of immigrants, of exiles, there was sort of an initial repulsion of your given culture, and you want to sort of blend in with, you know, whatever fiction you think being American is, And that's part, a lot of what I write about, sort of that initial rejection and the growing into loving your culture, or, you know, cultural coming of age story, which happens, of course, as we ourselves mature and become. So this poem is sort of a child's point of view or voice about the many problems I have with my name. The name I wanted, not Ricardo, but Richard, because I felt like Richard Burton, a true Anglo-Saxon in tights reciting lines from Othello, because I wanted to be as handsome as Richard Gere in a white tuxedo, because I had a pinky ring just like Richard Dawson on Family Feud, because I knew I could be just as wholesome as Richie Cunningham, just as American as my father's favorite president, Nixon. Richard, not Ricardo, not my nicknames either. And Negrito, the little black boy from my skin the color of dried tobacco when I was born, or El Gallaguito, the little Galician, because that's what Tia Noelia called anyone like me, born in Spain, not really 100% Cuban. And not Rico, the name Lupe wrote on my desk, branding me as Barry Manilow's Latin lover in ruffled sleeves dancing conga at the Copacabana all of eighth grade. And definitely not Ricardito, little Ricky, worse than Dick. Richard, descendant of British royals, not the shepherds of my mother's family, not the plantain farmers on my father's side. Richard, name of German composers, not the swish of machetes, rapping of bongos. Richard, more elegant than my grandfather in his polyester suit, chiclets jingling in his pocket. More refined than my grandmother gnawing on mangoes and passing gas at the kitchen sink. Ricardo de Jesus Blanco, I dub thee myself Sir Richard Jesus White, defender of my own country, protector of my wishes, conqueror of mirrors, sovereign of my imagination, a name for my name. Well, this poem comes from someone who is very, very central to my life, my grandmother, my abuelita, who is one of those relatives we have in our life who just loved me to death. One of those persons that was both my friend and my enemy, my greatest teacher, my greatest detractor, and a person who was also as homophobic as she was xenophobic. So that things that were culturally odd to her also were queer or gay. Things like Fruit Loops were gay, according to her. So, and this poem is sort of rifting on that a little bit, and really exposing her homophobia and me being the primary sort of victim of that or object of that homophobia. And it's written in her voice, which is a lot easier to get away with so that she can incriminate herself. And it's kind of a humorous look, but at the same time, it's, as I always say, I hope that you are laughing at her and not with her. Queer theory, according to my grandmother. Never drink your soda with a straw. Men don't use straws. Milkshakes, maybe. Stop buying your mother's Avon catalog and the men's underwear in those Sears flyers. I've seen you. Stay out of her Tupperware parties and perfume bottles. Don't let her kiss you. She kisses you much too much. Avoid hugging men, but if you must, pat them real hard on the back, even if it's your father. Must you keep that cat? Don't pet him so much. Mijo, why don't you like dogs? Never play house, even if you're the husband. And quit hanging out with that Henry kid. He's too pale. And I don't care what you call them, those G.I. Joes of his are dolls. Don't draw rainbows or flowers or sunsets. I've seen you. Don't draw at all, no coloring books either. Put away your crayons, your Play-Doh, your Legos. Where are your Hot Wheels, your laser gun and handcuffs? Those knives I gave you for Christmas. Never fly a kite or roller skate, but light all the firecrackers you want. Kill all the lizards you can, cut up worms, and feed them to that cat of yours. Don't sit Indian style with your legs crossed. You're no Indio. Stop click-clacking your sandals. You're no Tropicana chorus girl. I've seen you. Never take a bubble bath or wash your hair with shampoo. Shampoo is for women. So is conditioner. So is El Mousse. So is hand lotion. Never file your nails or blow dry your hair. Go to the barbershop with your abuelo. You're not unisex, are you? Stay out of the kitchen. Los hombres don't cook. They eat. Eat anything you want, except deviled eggs, blow pops, croissants, bagels, maybe, cucumber sandwiches, and those petite fours. Don't watch Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie. Don't stare at the $6 million man. I've seen you. Never dance alone in your room. Donna Summer, Barry Manilow, the Captain Antoniel, Bette Midler, and all musicals forbidden. Posters of kittens or Star Wars or the Eiffel Tower forbidden. Those fancy books on architecture and art, I threw them in the trash. No, you can't wear cologne or puka shells. And I better not catch you in clogs. If you grow a ponytail, I'm cutting it off. What? Okay? No, you can't pierce your ear, left or right side. I don't care. You will not look like a goddamn queer. I've seen you, even if I know you are one.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Richard Blanco, reading his poetry. Richard, I wanted to ask you, we've talked about this a little bit, but, you know, after having been the inaugural poet for President Obama, has that affected your aesthetic as a poet, your sense of how you look at your own work, or in terms of craft, even the work of others?
Yes, I mean, I've really gained an incredible, a whole wide door has been opened, not just emotionally, but also in terms of craft and aesthetics and thinking about what a poem can do, what a poem should do, what beyond sort of, beyond the way I was writing poems before. And it all has to do with the idea of the occasional poem and how a poem can live in public space and how a poem can be this hold so much more than I ever thought. And how something can be at once public and private at the same time. The inaugural poem being one example, and since then I've sort of done about maybe 7 or 8 different occasional poems or commissioned poems, and they're great challenges. I think that every workshop, every sort of writing course, every writing program should have this as an exercise, because what happens is, and for one thing, you actually have a real audience, and it's a really interesting thing to write for a real audience that's going to be the people that receive this poem in that one moment. Then you have the larger audience, of course, that you know is going to read this poem outside of it. And then you have the audience of your peers, because you're also writing, well, we're always writing in sort of with the audience of our peers in mind. But that triangulation is really interesting. It's not sort of this abstract audience. Sort of, we talk about having audience in poetry, but it's always an abstraction, you know, who are we writing for or whatnot. Here you have an actual tangible audience, and your challenge sometimes is how to fulfill that moment with that audience, but also how to make the poem bigger than that moment as well. And it's kind of an exaggerated thing of what we try to do in our own poems. How do we make our poems this intimate, private, and honest thing that also relates large in a larger sense to the world? And so it's taught me that, you know, that it's about making that connection tangible, that sort of, what do I care about that my audience cares about as well, and where is that connection? And approaching the poem from that way is kind of just really neat. I mean, I feel like I've learned how to play the same song but in a different instrument. Mm-hmm. Not that I will never write sort of more intimate but autobiographical poems, but the idea that suddenly I have another instrument that I can use.
Yeah. I guess there's nothing to compare it to sitting down to write that inaugural poem. I mean, it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and it was, I guess, it was really my first occasional poem. I had written another occasional poem, but it was by choice. It was for actually one of my engineering projects, and I wrote a poem for the groundbreaking ceremony. Well, I didn't intend it for the groundbreaking ceremony, but I ended up reading for it, reading it at the groundbreaking. But this was an official sort of occasional poem. And, you know, the hardest part of it, I've been writing for a while now. So, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, I know I can, you know, I know I can write a poem. The question is, how long will it take? Or how good will it be? Or how bad will it be? But I had a week, so to argue, you know, write the most important poem of my life. A week. I had three. I had to write three poems in 3 weeks, so I gave myself a week for each.
That's
for
amazing.
Each poem. And I gotta say, there's something to be said about the timed exercise versus having 3 months. In which case, who knows what would have happened to me? I would have like disappeared and gone to live in Alaska or something. So I'm kind of glad that they didn't give me that much time, but. Yeah. But part of the challenge that again was sort of a heightened sense of what I actually go through every poem is about finding that emotional center,
yeah.
And how to enter the poem, how to what is it that you can hang everything else around in the poem, what is that core, and I had to do a lot of sort of personal, and to get there we have to ask a lot of personal questions, a lot of deep questions, and for me those questions were, am I American?
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't quite sure yet. You know, I thought I still needed to be Peter Brady or Martha Brady. Am I, you know, do I love this country? Am I that attached to this country that I can be honest about it in a poem? Things like that. I didn't feel I had the emotional authority to write the poem at first. And it was actually because of Sandy Hook that opened this emotional door to see that, yes, I am indeed part of this family, this nation, village, this family. And that's why that reference to Sandy Hook is in the poem. That was the thing that sort of opened my heart and gave me a center to the poem.
Well, that's great. It's a wonderful poem. Unfortunately, we have time for just one more, if you would read one. Thank you.
I don't think this needs much explaining, but it's sort of about the one that got away. Maybe for Craig. Maybe it was the billboards promising paradise. Maybe those 59 miles with your hand in mine. Maybe my sexy roadster, the top down. Maybe the wind fingering your hair, sun on your thighs and bare chest. Maybe it was just the ride over the sea split in two by the highway to Key Largo, or the idea of Key Largo. Maybe I was finally in the right place at the right time with the right person. Maybe there'd be a house, a dog named Chew, a lawn to mow, neighbors, dinner parties, and you forever obsessed with crossword puzzles and Carl Jung, reading in the dark by the moonlight at the bedside every night. Maybe. Maybe it was the clouds paused at the horizon, the blinding fields of golden sawgrass, the mangrove islands tangled, inseparable as we might be. Maybe I should have said something, promised you something, asked you to stay a while. Maybe.
The poetry of Richard Blanco. Thank you so much. That was great, Richard.
Thanks. Pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.